up here again. I'm just moderating this conversation. And we'll get questions from the audience. Maybe we'll open this way. Are there any questions that arose for you that you might have for each other?
Well, we were just, Reese and I were just talking about, we both grew up Catholic, and I grew up very, very Catholic, and even though there was the, I wasn't non-material, there was always a part of me that wanted to have something I could devote myself to, or to have that kind of structure. Like, I had this image of a room with a little bed and a waste basket, and I would just be in a, what do you call them, convent? Mm-hmm. I would just give myself, I'd be able to just fully give myself to God and Jesus, and not really understanding what this all meant, really, but it felt, I had a longing for that. And I was also religious until sort of the, you know, church and queerness didn't get along. But there were other reasons also. But I was just relating to that sense of loss, mm-hmm. that sense of loss of something that has a structure and a soul. And then I was telling stories about my aunt who became a Pentecostal believer and faith healer, and she left the Catholic Church. So we were just having that conversation. So I guess I wanted to hear a little bit more about your, if you don't mind, your personal experience with Catholicism, and then the religion that inspired the loss, that inspired the book.
Yeah. No, of course. I also, as was mentioned, I also grew up Catholic. But then when I was in junior high, I started, you know, it's funny, my mother is so religious, was in turn, she was so religious that she considered becoming a nun before she met my father. So a lot of would-be nuns floating around.
Almost nuns.
Nun wannabes.
Let's see. So I grew up Catholic, and then when I was in junior high and high school, so I went to a high school that it's a public school in Southern California, and it's maybe 80% Asian, and mostly Korean. I'm Korean. And I don't fully know what it is about my people, but when we get religious, we just like go for it. Like we're not chill people. We just sort of we get extreme about things really fast in a lot of ways. There's a running joke. It's not really much of a joke, and that it's very sad in some ways, but that Koreans just like really got into it with Confucianism too. Korea's sort of like a stronghold of Confucianism still. And that like the Koreans decided to like make themselves like the best communists too. Like we're really good children.
Intensity to things.
Yeah. And so my friends were just like extremely Protestant. All my friends' idea of a good, of like a really fun Friday was like going to youth group and like singing and dancing and talking in tongues. And I think a lot of people who haven't experienced that kind of religion, that kind of ecstatic religion, don't really know how fun it is, because it was really fun. You know, it was so joyful. People would always be crying. People would be talking to God. So there really hasn't been anything else like it. Like, I mean, I've tried, you know, that kind of just like wholesale fervor and joy. Mm-hmm. And so
without drugs,
exactly. That's what's wild. It doesn't hurt your brain. Well, I mean, in other ways, it arguably is. Well, we'll see. And not that all drugs hurt your brain, obviously, but so that was what happened. It was just like a mishmash of things, and for me, people always want to know what made you lose your faith, and mm-hmm. I'm curious about you. You sort of answered that, but for me, it wasn't any one big thing. It was just like an accumulation of questions that I at least could not answer within the framework that of the religion that as I understood it. And one big thing for me was how much I was reading, because I was always reading. I always loved reading, and it became increasingly impossible, especially the more I fell into like increasingly rigid Protestantism. It became increasingly impossible to believe that everyone who did not believe exactly what I believed was going to go to hell. because I was reading and reading from the points of view inhabiting the minds of people who did not believe what I believed. Mm-hmm. So I remember I would read Voltaire and try to pray for his soul because it seemed like he probably wasn't Christian enough to make it to heaven. And I wasn't really sure how the timeline of like, well, he died a long time ago. Like how, when do people go to hell? Like my theology was all mixed up because I was sort of sampling from different kinds of Christianity. But yeah, I would just like pray and pray and pray as I read, and eventually I couldn't anymore. But what about you? What was the...
Wow. Okay. So I joined the Baha'is and did fireside chats and tried to be saved on a bus in Guatemala by someone who came and knelt in front of me. This was when I was like 19 and asked me if I wanted to pray with her. And I said, yes. I've been asked several times that. And I was very sincere and I thought, this might be a real way, because I was really looking for something to take my life over. That's what I was really looking for, someone to take my life over so I didn't have to do it. And I, you know, bumbled around and did different things with religions, and then I think I'm just still Catholic. That I told my father once before he died, he asked me something, he said, well, do you not believe in the Bible anymore at all? And I said, you know, Dad, I believe at the same time that a part of me believes every story about Jesus, about Lazarus rising decayed and stinky from the dead, and about the wine and the water, everything, every story I believe, and at the same time, another part of me, probably larger part of me, knows that they're stories, and that just coexists. So maybe that's the kid brain, the imaginative brain, and the kid brain up against the brain of an adult that I, you know, that where I have experienced a lot of different things. He found that very interesting, and he said, well, I kind of agree. Mm-hmm. So he said, I think everybody has that. So I thought that was interesting, that maybe that isn't so unusual. But I just have my own way of having faith in, I don't know, dust particles. Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, like that. So...
Did you ever, do you find or have you found that sort of the routine that you were drawn to, the routine-driven life that you were drawn to, and this idea of like something large sort of overpowering you? Do you find any of that in literature, in a life of?
No, what a wonderful.
In a writing life.
Thing to think about. Yes, I think when I started fully immersing myself in reading and writing, and this would have been in my late 20s, I would say that I devoted myself to that like a nun. And I did. It was the organizing principle of my life was sitting in this little molded out, every year flooded out basement, you know, apartment. And with my white cat and reading and writing in this big closet that I put a desk in. Mm-hmm. And I was devoted to it. It was an organizing principle of my life. And that's what I was really looking for, mm-hmm. something to organize. And that's what writing and reading became for me then, yeah.
I was just reading a profile of Sigrid Nunez, where she said that, the novelist Sigrid Nunez, where she said that she felt, she's, maybe this is old-fashioned, but that she really believes that writing is a calling, a vocation, mm-hmm. like being a nun or a monk, and that we have literary traditions in which writers have kind of occupied that kind of social role, a search for meaning, ecstatic. We were just nerding out together about, full disclosure, about Virginia Woolf, who I think of as a very ecstatic writer, mm-hmm. To the point of mystic and the way that she kind of plumbs consciousness through language. Mm-hmm. So I think there is a tradition of that. There is a space in literary world. We can all make meaning for ourselves of what it means to be a writer, but there is space for this idea, right, of writing as a calling, as a vocation, as something that kind of is a conduit for our passion and for our devotional passion, for our search for meaning.
And company.
And company.
To be accompanied. Mm-hmm. Just be accompanied by books and the pen and the notebooks and the language. My mind works better. It organizes my brain. Whatever comes from it, my brain gets organized around when I start having that relationship with my own imagination and language. Mm-hmm. So I was thinking company, accompanied.
Has it been that for you?
It is when, so when I'm deep in the writing, and I wonder if it's like that for you, when I'm deep in the writing, and I'm just like really hanging out with the sentence and trying to get a sentence right. I really do, that part that I just read with Phoebe saying that her playing comes from a place without ego, that part was at least emotionally autobiographical for me, in that when I'm writing, I really feel that when the best stuff is happening, I'm not there anymore. I no longer am making decisions. I'm just sort of, like the sense of an I disappears. I always lose track of time. I lose all sense of appetite. And I love it. I love being there. I don't know how to get there, though. I can't mm-hmm. force my way there. Mm-hmm. The only way to get there is to just keep trying. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the other thing that at least what was a religious temperament has left me with is a faith in showing up, is a faith in routine. Because mm-hmm. I think especially Catholics, at least the Catholics I grew up with, Catholics don't emphasize quite as much, and a lot of you might know, don't really emphasize as much the act of like belief. What they emphasize more is the action and the sort of showing up to church, going to confession, going to mass. It's almost like the routine will birth belief. The actions will lead to feeling. And I think that I believe in that very much with writing, that if I personally, I know a lot, not everybody needs this, but I'm such a better writer. I'm such a happier, better person if I'm writing every day. And the minute I let myself go for even one day, I can just, everything starts collapsing. Mm-hmm. But
yeah. Questions. Yes, Gina.
Wait.
Here comes the mic.
The mic that doesn't work?
No, it records does your work. Voice.
So this is a message for R.O. Kwam. Let's see, my question was about your faith and your writing and your family. Is your family still Christian and religious, and how do they feel about this book that you wrote? And, you know, it's kind of a few questions. And my last question is, how do you, since you have lost your faith, and I'm not religious myself, but since you have lost your faith, how do you fit into your family and your community?
No, that's a great question. And that's, well, let's put it, my family and I, my parents and I, my brother and I, we're very close. That said, my parents and my brother are extremely religious. Thank goodness, their version of Catholicism, they're like four times a week. My parents are like four times a week churchgoers, but they never voted for 45. They don't like 45. So we're not divided politically at the very least. So there's that. So the way it works is my mother is a woman of great faith, and she essentially believes that she's going to pray me back into the faith, like tomorrow or like maybe Sunday. Like she's like just like a couple more days, and she's going to get there. So she's like a very cheerful woman of faith, and I have inherited some of her stubbornness, and I'm pretty sure that this isn't going to happen. So that's just, we're just sort of going along on this road. And so I, you know, like, especially this past year, there's been a lot of news and a lot of changes. And so if I had something good happen, like a nice review or something, I would forward it to them, to my family, to my parents. And my mother would very charmingly would read every single review, interview, listen to every podcast, listen to all of it. But if it was particularly good news, my mother would write back, "So happy for you, congratulations, God made this happen, but your mother was praying for you, so actually your mother made this happen." So she would just cheerfully take credit for it. I'd be like, sure, sure, sure.
The power of my prayer.
Yeah. Thank goodness your mother was praying for you, since you were doing it for yourself. So, so that's where we are, you know. And I will still, if I'm home, and just to be nice to her, and even though I at this point like strongly disapprove of and don't want anything to do with the Catholic Church as it is. That said, sometimes just to, because she's my mother and because I love her, I will go to church with her. But for me, it's like going to, you know, like, it's an errand of love for mm-hmm. my parents. And it's, mm-hmm. it has nothing to do with, I'm just like bored out of my mind and also sort like hurt and sad sitting there. My husband, who did not grow up with any religion, he's attended church with us a couple of times. And he's never been in like a Catholic mass. And if you've been in a Catholic mass, oh my God, it's so long. The people who've experienced Catholic masses are like, yes, it's so long. And if you've gone more than once, almost all of it's repeated. And so it's even more incredibly boring if it's not something that you're excited about. So I'll go, but it's no longer part of my life. Yeah.
This question is for Ms. Kwan. You said the book took you 10 years to write. So can you just kind of walk us not through that entire process, but like from draft one, right, or year one to year 10, like what radical changes did the book go through? Like, for example, the rotation of like point of view from Phoebe to John, was that in the original draft, or like the dropping of the quotation markers? Were there some things that you came, you know, with the first draft, like I intended to do these things, and then some things kind of radically changed stylistically.
Yeah. No, that's a great question. The book went through so many drafts that I truly have no idea if it was like 50 drafts or like 100. But it was like something like that, like some like gigantic number. I don't want to know, I think, because I don't want to know what it's going to take for me to finish my next book and the book after that. I just need to like forget as much as possible so I can find the energy to be excited about going through all of it all over again. But so with the first book, the first 2 years, in retrospect, I think were kind of a mistake, in that I've spent the first 2 years. I spent the first 2 years, they felt like 20 years, just sort of frantically reworking the first 20 pages of the book over and over mm-hmm. and over again. I just wanted like a really perfect first chapter. Like I wanted the sentences, I love sentences, I wanted the sentences to be exactly right before I could move on. Mm-hmm. And I got tripped up on a metaphor, and the metaphor was, I was like, I just kept muttering about foundations. Like I was like, if you're going to build a house, you need a solid foundation. If the foundation has a crack in it, the house will crack too. I also grew up in LA, so you know I'm very conscious of like foundations cracking and like houses falling. Yeah, exactly. So, and you know, a house needs to be well built. And so I just like muttered about foundations for two years, and then at the end of that, I threw it all away. And then I realized I'd gotten tripped up by this metaphor, because you can't lay a foundation if you don't know what the house looks like, if you just have absolutely no idea what the house looks like. And so after that, I started doing things to speed more quickly through drafts, and forcing myself to do things messily and to be able to, and to just live with that until I had more of a sense of who mm-hmm. these characters were, what they wanted of one another, like why they were even hanging out in a space together. And that took a lot of drafts. And then once I had that sort of creaky story in place, that's when I could start doing, for me, the fun part, because I don't like that kind of sloppy drafting. Is not fun for me. That truly feels like drudgery, work, and confusion. What I really love, like a really good day for me, is if I can just spend a day with like two sentences.
Yes.
Moving around some.
That's heaven.
Yeah.
Yes.
Moving around some words.
Yeah.
Changing a comma to an M dash and then changing it back.
Yes.
And then at the end of like.
And reading it out loud.
Yes.
Yeah. And seeing how it feels.
Yes.
Like, oh.
And then moving it somewhere else in the manuscript, yes. And then moving it back. And then like after 5 hours of that, I'm just like, I have done what I was put on this earth to do. I moved around some commas.
See?
Is that how you?
Right. I get like this. I just get drawn in. Not in the first. In the beginning, things will just fly out into notebooks, and then, or for the fifth woman anyway, I would sort of point my head towards that color or sound of that world, and that narrator, and that grief, And then as I would revise, I just would be like closer, like I was doing, I don't know, moving dust, moving little bits of dust around, or feeling this and trying out this word and reading it out loud to my writer's group. And just, it was, I loved that part.
Mm-hmm.
Really
mm-hmm.
loved that part. Mm-hmm. The sentence.
That's the best part. Yeah.
I love that. Yeah.
I forget which painter it was, but somebody asked a painter, like, why are you a painter? Like, how did you get there? And he was just like, I love paint.
Yes.
I love paint. I love moving it around. I love having it on my hands. I love the colors. And I was like, I love words, you know? I really love words. Language. I really love thinking about them. I love just staring at them. I learned the other day this word plit, P-L-I-T.
Huh.
It means a clump of earth or clay that has been evenly split in half. Isn't that wild? There's a word for that. Somebody just decided to, at some point, that people needed a word for that, and they called it a plit.
So specific.
I know, isn't it great? Yeah. I really need to use it. And it's going to like somehow find a use for
so
it.
So wait a minute. So the plit, okay, so here's a thing of dirt,
yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
So you get this very fine axe and you go and you cut it in half. So each half is a plit?
I think.
Or is the plit the cut?
Like the space between the pieces of clay that you cut?
I thought it was the earth. The earth or clay itself.
The two pieces together, the whole thing.
Yeah, the whole thing. Yeah.
That's been
I don't know why they
half.
Needed it so neat, so exactly to be half, but hey, it is very evocative of a clip. That's true.
Well, there you go.
We were just talking in my translation class today about Emily Wilson, who is the first woman to translate the Odyssey into English. And we were just reading this interview with her, and it's sitting with me as we're talking about it, that she said, you know, if we believe that stories matter, then how we tell stories matter.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens on the microscopic level of word choice.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And she was talking about within translation, right? Like every little word changes the gradation. But of course, as writers, that is equally true. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That every single, is it a comma? Is it an M dash? Mm-hmm. Is it a semicolon? You have that masterful semicolon towards the end of the book. That is so much work. And you have these moments, like these breathtaking moments where the cadence of your sentences is just undergirding this character's grief. And it's sort of like pushing towards the unspoken, right, through the rhythm of the sentences, you know, this kind of work that is so on a granular level, right,
mm-hmm.
the microscopic word level that reflects on the macro,
mm-hmm.
that stories matter,
mm-hmm.
that the stories we tell matter,
mm-hmm.
and we can do that just by moving commas around.
Yes, yes, yeah, it's not frivolous, it's not a waste of time, it is truly, it feels
exactly.
like a really good use of time.
Right, we play with language and words, but it matters.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other so many the vocabulary that you don't even know exists, like the richness of language. Okay. Other questions from folks? Yes,
hi,
sir.
Hi there.
Hi.
This is to both of you, and I'm fascinated by the idea of slowing down and taking a look at the words and the punctuation and all that.
Mm.
In your writings, do you ever slow down to the point that you get off the computer or off the keyboard and begin to write out sentences, handwriting? Going slowly, taking a look at the sentences.
I write, the fifth woman was all first written in notebooks by hand, and I was following a certain, I knew when I was inside that world that I would then follow a certain mood, sound, cadence, and I would write slowly and follow it until something sort of made its own little arc. And then only after I found something, there's a lot of writing without finding anything, that then I would move that into the computer and go, oh, I found something. Here's something. And then I would type it up and work from there, draft after draft.
Mm.
Yeah. They were often started with exercises that my writer's group and I gave to each other. We would read a poem or a piece of a, story or essay or something, and then we would just take off and go for a couple of hours, and I think all of the pieces came out that way, either whole or in pieces, but drafty draft stuff, and then, yeah. So notebook writing is how I write.
I do write some drafts by hand, but for me, it's less about, my handwriting is very messy, and so for me, it's helpful to write drafts by hand, to write early drafts by hand, because then I can write a sentence, and I look at it, and I truly cannot, I can't obsess over it the way I can on the computer screen. So for me, it's a way to just, like, speed through a draft and just, like, get over myself and get over my own obsessions for a little while until I can get back there. And I have a friend who, amazingly, she also really loves sentences, is such a beautiful writer. She'll write her first 3-4 drafts extremely quickly by hand, and extremely quickly, like I think between like a month and 3 months per draft. But with each draft, she'll then throw it away. She wouldn't even read it. But she's just trying to like find her way into the story by trying to like slam it down. And then after she's written those 3 drafts, she'll turn to the computer and then start all over again.
What an awesome process.
It's also nice to believe that nothing gets wasted and every work of art is a palimpsest of all your waste of all the drafts that went before.
Compost, yes.
At the very least, it feels better than.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. It's good to tell yourself that.
Nothing
yeah.
Is wasted.
True.
Yeah. It's part of the process. Yeah. Other questions? Yes, Brian.
Hi, I have this question for both of you, but. Ms. Kwan, so you said it took 10 years to get this book finished, and so my question is, how do you, I guess, stay in that space of keeping something to your original intent while at the same time being relevant to the time that you release it? I guess my question is, how do you kind of silence that noise of other people maybe had that idea first, or I don't want to be too influenced by outside media, or if you know, anything like that. Just how do you keep aware of that, and how do you account for that when writing?
That's a great question. So trying to stay true to what you want the book to be without being too worried about the outside world. I don't worry too much about it in general. I think in that anything you write just feels so, it's so personal, right? Like any book requires so much of just you that I know there are people who, like, for instance, I know there are novelists who will never read fiction while they're writing a book. And like, that's wild to me because I love to read. I love to read fiction in particular. I also love nonfiction and poetry and plays and all of it. But my true love is fiction and my truest love is novels. And so for me to deny myself that, I also feel as the books are truly made of other books. I'm not the first person to say that. But books are made of other books, and if I'm reading all the time, then those books are as much a part of my lived experience, if not more, maybe, than everything else I go through. And the other thing is, I just don't think, in some ways, the world is a more terrifying place than it was 10 years ago. In other ways, it was terrifying 10 years ago, too. Mm-hmm. And I feel as though a lot of what we're struggling with and a lot of what's scary every day was just as scary 10 years ago, was just as present, and things haven't changed that much, and things don't change all that quickly by and large. Mm-hmm. But what about you?
I don't remember the question. I really don't. It's terrible.
Essentially, the question is, how do you keep your writing pure while
worrying? Well, I don't know about keeping the writing pure or keeping pure. I can't relate to that, but I know what you're trying to say is that I don't want to keep it pure. It's like I want to let in aspects of the world, whatever text catches my attention, whether it be the text of a tree, or the text of my dog, or the text of I just was I was I short while back read the Tommy Orange They're There, and did all of James Baldwin again recently, and redid Virginia Woolf, did Moby Dick again. So then I just am giving myself over to that story and to that, to those words. But I think that I'm absorbing when I'm reading, I'm absorbing, and I'm gonna make my own what is my own in this place where there sort of are no possessives anyway. So I just follow. I do a lot of following, intuitive following. If something is catching me or pulling me towards it, you know, then I move towards it, and I don't really, you know, then we digest, I think. I think of it as digestion. It becomes, somehow it comes out part of your own language and your own obsessions and stories, because it all gets all mixed together, right? That first dog you had who, you know, rolled around on the grass and then got run over by a, you know, motorcycle. That didn't happen to me, I made that up. But the, you know, gets all mixed up with something else in, you know, a James Baldwin book, you know, or in Giovanni's room, where he's in that room and just in that room. So these are great questions. Anybody have another one?
I was just going to ask if you might follow up just a little bit more about the digestion in relation to the horse piece.
The horse. I read that. Yeah. So here's the story under the story, because there's always stories under and around a story, right? So I'm in Eastern Europe. I'm in a little town called Slavonica. My girlfriend and I at the time, meaning my girlfriend at that time, and I'm hanging out in this big old, probably, I don't know, 13th century stone building with wooden windows wide open, and then I want something to do. I don't want to go outside because it's too hot. So I pick up a New Yorker that I shoved into my luggage before I left. And I'm, you know, I'm looking at it. And there's a story by Samantha Hunt called 3 Days. So that's a story. That's a real story. And then my story that I wrote is pretty close to the story, only I wasn't in an apartment. I was in Eastern Europe in a small town called Slavonica. But I was reading the story and I went, oh no, out loud. Oh no, the horse is gonna die. And I just didn't have it in me. You know, I'm really affected by music also, but stories, and so I set it down, and I did. I looked at the back of my hand, because that soothes me. If you ever really get upset in the world, and you're out there on your own, and or something is really upsetting you, try it sometime. You can just look at the back of your hand and just focus on it. There's something about that. It's a little bit like feeling the weight of your legs on the ground, that it just calms me down. So then I went out. And maybe because it keeps the focus small and there's not a horse dying, but there's just, my hand is taking up the whole stage, whereas the horse is now over here, over there. So then I went out and cleaned this little bathroom, and then I walked around and I just went through this process. And then I started writing it down as I went through it. And I just started writing it down, and I had a draft within a couple hours, and then I came back and read it to someone, and they were like, oh, I think you found something. I went, yeah, I know I found something. So then I started revising and making it happen within the world of this world, this narrator. Maybe I didn't know this narrator existed yet. I don't know what came first. I just kept finding things, but that was that's a great question. Mm-hmm. The digestion. That one was direct, a direct story about the digestion. And I really did have the question, like, what is this? Why? Mm. Why? I went through a crisis of faith with fiction, with novels especially. For years, I would not read novels. I was just like, I'm not going to be pulled in to this. It's just, I get very compelled and lose sight of my life and blah, blah, blah. And I just thought, I'm not going to do that. And I like the intensity of short stories, and I like the intensity of short forms quite a bit. So, I just had a crisis of faith. What does that mean? It just meant that I didn't understand anymore. Like, gosh, I get so emotionally affected by some of this stuff. Like, why? What is this for? What do we gain? And then, of course, I know what we gain, and I know what it's for, because those things are happening all the time. You know, the horse is dying outside of Walmart every day as we go about our 50 choices of bubble gum. Mm-hmm. You know, we have 50 choices in the United States. We have 50 kinds of bubble gum now, if not more. Imagine that. That is just too much. That is just too much. No wonder we are getting in so much trouble over and over and over again. It's all that bubble gum.
Meanwhile, the horse is dying
over and over again. So, thank you for that question.
Such a rich reflection. Do we have time for one more question?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Great. One more question. Who will it be? Hands. Is that a hand?
Yeah. Cynthia.
All right. So you both have just had these very successful books come out in the last year. And I know you're probably enjoying the wave of adulation and all the awards that are coming your way. But something else has to be in the works. And I wanted to find out if you're already in development with something new and what that development process is like coming after, you know, these big pieces of work. Mm. It's probably more digestion, but.
I have been working for a while. I mean, for me right now, my process has changed a lot over the last, I don't know how many years, but things come out in pieces because that's how I can work. So I'm working on a memoir, and I almost read from it tonight, but then I'm not ready. But yeah, I'm working on a memoir that's called, so far, A Small Hole in the Lake of the Morning, which is actually a line from William, it's an erasure line. I did an erasure and got that line out of William something, not Styron, not, So Long, See You Tomorrow, who wrote that? Maxwell, you know.
Maxwell, yeah.
Maxwell, so from Maxwell. So yeah, so I'm writing, they're just these pieces of something, I call them, that eventually will puzzle their way, I think, into a book, eventually. Mm. I don't know. I don't like to think like that. I don't like thinking ahead very much. I like to pretend that I never know where I'm going ever, ever, ever until it's published. Oh, God, there it is!
I've been working for almost 3 years now. I keep saying 2.5, but at some point I'm going to start having to say 3, and I don't want to, because I don't want this next book to take quite so long. And the numbers are, it's just like the time is piling up once again. but I've been working on this book for a little while, and it's centered on, I'm still having trouble talking about it, but it's centered on two women. One's a choreographer and one's a photographer. For now, who knows, maybe they'll change on me, but... the book is very interested in questions of what women are allowed to want versus what women aren't allowed to want. Things that women are allowed to want basically have to do with taking care of other people. So it's a subsidiary want. It's a want that's subordinate to other people, right? You can take care of your children, you can take care of your you can take care of a partner, you can take care of anyone in the community, you can take care of. But once women start wanting things for themselves, that starts scaring people so much. And so I think I'm just fascinated by this, and the book is exploring that. That said, something about what you said, because I know there are a number of writing students in here, right? I don't know if this is true for everybody, but I know it's true for a lot of people. And I heard this so many times before I published a book, and I never believed it. So I'm going to say it, and you probably won't believe me either. I barely believe myself, but I swear it's true, at least for a lot of the writers I know. I think like 99% of the writers I know. None of the publication, none of it ever feels as good as the actual writing. The real joy is in the writing. It's in the sentences. It's in the day-to-day work. None of the rest of it, no matter how it looks from the outside, I think, it just doesn't. It will turn to nothing, and the true, you're here for the work and the words and the beauty of the language and the power of the language, and that's where the real joy is.
Word.